little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Hearty welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And I'm along with co-host.
I'm Julia Minton.
And if we ask her nicely, Julia might just tell us how you can get in touch with us, give us some feedback about the show, suggest some future topics for us. You can pop up our previously archived versions of our podcast of this show.
Yeah, you can find our previous versions of our show with your podcast app. Just open up your podcast app and add feed, search for Thinking Clearly, and you'll find us. You can also visit us at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. Mm-hmm. That's L-I-B-S-Y-N. And we also have a Facebook. Bob and I are, in fact, real people behind the Facebook page, and we love hearing from you, your suggestions for topics, feedback about how our shows went, and it really makes a difference. We've had a number of shows based on the suggestions and feedbacks of our listeners.
Yeah, our list is growing just from our feedback that we get from listeners, and I'm going to give a couple quotes that will kind of lead us into the topic. Here's the first quote. It goes like this. Belief can be manipulated, but only knowledge is dangerous. And that's a quote from Frank Herbert. Do you know who Frank Herbert is?
He wrote sci-fi novels, right?
Yeah, sure. He wrote Dune and the five sequels to that. And,
so the best sci-fi novels.
Oh, yeah. He was great.
Spicy.
Yeah. And he wrote also, he was known for those novels. He was known for Dune, but he actually did a lot of short stories, worked as a newspaper journalist, a photographer, book reviewer, and a lecturer. Here's the second quote. Nothing is so firmly believed as that which we least know. And that's a quote from Michel de Montaigne. See, I'm not the philosopher. You're the philosopher. So
it's all right. I don't think he minds.
I looked up the pronunciation of that, and I can't get my mouth in that kind of French position to say it correctly. Montaigne. He was one of the most significant philosophers of the French Renaissance, also known for popularizing the essay as a literary genre.
Oh.
So the topic tonight is what?
I don't know. And I have notes in front of me.
Well, read them.
Tonight we're talking about belief formation, influence of beliefs on reasoning, and belief change with a guest.
And I'm going to tell you about our guest is Dr. Michael Wolff. He's a professor of psychology, department chair, and co-director of the Social Cognition Lab. They're at Grand Valley State University. That's in Allendale, Michigan. Professor Wolff has authored and co-authored numerous papers on topics ranging from memory and text processing to the influence that beliefs have on evaluating arguments. And a few topics that currently intrigue him are how reading processes change when people read information that is either consistent or inconsistent with beliefs that they hold, and factors that influence the extent to which we will change our beliefs in response to information. He's also interested in how beliefs influence our ability to reason about arguments and utilize information that is either consistent or inconsistent with those beliefs. And when our beliefs do change, why do we seem so relatively unaware of these changes? So those are going to be the topics that we're going to talk about tonight. Professor Wolff, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks. Hi, Bob and Julia. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, and I know it's a little bit later, 3 hours later where you are there. So thank you for staying up late for us, and we've really been looking forward to this conversation.
So thanks so much for joining us, Professor Wolff.
Mike. Whichever.
I like Mike. Mike rolls off the tongue.
Mike is fine.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your research has focused on the details of cognitive processes that occur when we comprehend text, and more recently on how our pre-existing beliefs may affect how we reason about arguments and utilize information, kind of like Bob was talking about. I'm curious, what led you to this path of research?
Well, so my graduate training and a lot of my early research, as you've said, was on text comprehension. So a lot of the questions I was interested in were things like, as people read, as you try to take in information, how do you remember or understand what you read? How do you integrate new information that you're trying to learn with information or things that you already know? And when does that process work and when does that process not work? And so I had been doing that for a while. And at some point, maybe 10 years ago, plus or minus, I started to become interested in people reading information that conflicted or was consistent with beliefs. And it was one of these things where I think I was just at a point in my research where I was kind of ready to look at something a little bit new. And at least the way I remember it, this may be a distortion, but I saw an letter to the editor in the local newspaper that somebody had written. And it was one of these things where in Michigan, you know, we have these winter snowstorms, there was this blizzard, and a guy wrote in mocking global warming, saying, you know, essentially the all the snow on the ground sort of reveals the foolishness of global warming. And I started thinking, you know, how do we understand people like this? So is somebody who in that sort of case would deny climate change, we were more calling it global warming back then, would it be the case that somebody like this maybe has read the literature or read some of the scientific information and his beliefs somehow prevented him from understanding it? Did he understand the information perfectly well but rejected it anyway? Was there some other sort of motivation going on? And so those kinds of questions, kind of how do people read scientific information or evidence and arguments that conflicts or is consistent with their beliefs? And in particular, could you get people to just change their beliefs to bring them in line with scientific evidence if you explained it more clearly? So originally I thought, well, coming from a text comprehension background, there are things we know about how to write information to make it easier for people to understand. And maybe that's kind of what's going on, that you just explain information more clearly and people will get it. So we started doing these studies in which we would have people report beliefs on various topics and read information. And it pretty quickly became clear to me that when you're dealing with beliefs and when people change beliefs or why they believe things, comprehending information is just not where the action is. I've come to learn this from reading more journal articles since then. I talked to some people at conferences who would say, oh, no, comprehension's not the important factor. But that was kind of what initially led me to it, was sort of wondering how people understood information and, you know, was understanding it a some sort of block towards getting people to accept scientific conclusions.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I can see how I could kind of share that curiosity, but not quite the patience to dig into it. So that's really interesting. Thanks.
It is a long slog through these things. So patience is definitely part of it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, in your writings, you discuss the definition of belief and contrast belief with knowledge and attitude, something that, you know, we've definitely talked about all those topics here on Thinking Clearly. Could you kind of take us through that exercise of contrasting belief with knowledge and attitude?
Sure. So one of the things that we learned kind of early on is that even in the scientific study of these things, there's not complete agreement on what beliefs are. So we've kind of learned that we define beliefs and try to be clear about what our definitions are. But I think the first point to begin with this question is this idea that the mind does not have any kind of truth filter or any sort of mechanism by which we could only let in information that's accurate and kind of reject information that we keep out, but rather we sort of know or have knowledge about things that we encounter. So in cognitive psychology, the way we talk about this often is about knowledge representation, where what we would call knowledge is essentially everything that we know. So things that we've read or heard or conversations that we have. Within our knowledge, there are certain topics about things that we would think are either kind of true of the world or not true of the world. And another important point is that our belief about the truth in something doesn't necessarily align with actual truth as it exists in the world. So again, there's no guarantee that what we think is true is actually true. But a belief then is something we define as a statement about truth value in the world. So to kind of give you a couple of examples, knowledge would be things like, I can read stories about dragons, I could describe the properties of dragons, but I do not believe that dragons actually exist, right? I also can understand that some people think that vaccines cause autism or that the world is flat, and even though I know that some people believe those things, I do not believe those things to be true. So beliefs are, we define beliefs as statements about what's true in the world. And one of the reasons why we tend to study beliefs as opposed to attitudes, which I'll get to in just a second, is beliefs are something that has an educational component. So, for example, we expect students to know the steps involved in biological processes. We expect them to know information about evolution or climate change. And so teaching students about beliefs is something that we do. A lot of the topics that we actually study in our research are topics where the information may be sort of complicated and people vary in their beliefs. So some of the kinds of topics that we look at would be things like watching violent television makes you violent. And so some people believe that it does and others believe that it doesn't. And what makes that a belief question is that you could potentially collect evidence that would give you an answer. Right. That doesn't mean that there's a simple answer necessarily, but at least it's not right. Whether TV violence causes violence or not is not just subject to my opinion. You could actually go out and look for evidence about that. The extent to which homosexuality is a choice is another topic that sort of fits this kind of belief dimension. The extent to which gun control reduces gun violence. Evolution, to the extent to which, you know, evolution is real or not. So all those things we would define as beliefs. And attitude, then, attitudes are studied in social psychology actually a lot. They're sort of a major topic. And they have to do with feelings or emotions, or what's called affect, essentially things that you may feel positively or negatively about. So an example of this, I was just watching a 60-minute show on what they called the Emerald Triangle, which I guess is up in your neck of the woods, and it was about marijuana and the marijuana industry in California. So you could imagine people would have attitudes, you know, people may feel strongly about marijuana, right? So whether you think marijuana should be legal or not is not a belief question, it's more of an attitude, right? There's no right answer to that. There are belief issues that are related to marijuana, such as to what extent does marijuana have health benefits, or will legalizing marijuana result in increased tax revenues or not? Now, those are things that people could collect evidence about, but how you feel about marijuana may be a separate thing. So another example with homosexuality. Someone may believe that homosexuality is completely determined by genetics, and yet they may not be happy about that. So they may have an attitude that they wish homosexuality was a choice, but they may believe that it's not. So again, so we separate attitudes from beliefs, where the attitudes are about feelings and beliefs are statements about things that are true. And so even though there is more research on attitudes than there is on beliefs on the whole, we have specifically been looking at beliefs in the research that we do.
Let me see if I understand this, because we've talked in this show about descriptive claims versus prescriptive claims. And whereas prescriptive claims have to do with morals, ethics, and that sort of things, descriptive claims have to do with what's real in the world that we can get evidence for to fathom what is true in the world. But it sounds like you're putting attitudes under prescriptive claims. In other words, would you put what we think is right and wrong, what we believe is moral or ethical, under an attitude rather than a belief?
Yes, I would. Because it's not a fact. What you think is right or wrong in any particular situation is not something you would collect evidence about. You may collect evidence for supporting reasons that underlie your values or your attitudes, mm-hmm. but statement about what's right and wrong, on our definition, the way we have described them, would fall under an attitude or an opinion, right? Whereas a belief would be the descriptive stuff that you were just talking about.
Even though we can construct arguments, there's a whole field of moral philosophy which has to do with different ways of conducting an argument which will lead to a conclusion that has to do with our values, that has to do with our morals. This is a little bit different definition than kind of maybe we've talked about or that we're used to, but this is the definition that you're using when you're doing your research. Is that true?
That's true. So certainly there are plenty of arguments that relate to attitudes. In fact, there's a large literature on attitude change, right? So I may present arguments that are designed to try to change your attitude about abortion, for example.
Okay.
And those arguments would be claims that would have corresponding reasons that are used to justify the claims, all of which may be designed to change your opinions or your feelings about something. And so we would just separate the fact that with abortion is generally not a topic that we have studied so far, because whether abortion should be legal or not, for us falls under an attitude. So that's right.
So attitudes are not necessarily just emotional in origin in that kind of definition, because we can construct rational arguments, moral arguments. But you're saying
more like a disposition.
A disposition, yeah. We may have a certain disposition towards taking on a certain type of moral argument over others. We may be a consequentialist, you know, rather than a deontologist. We've talked a little bit about that, and maybe that's our disposition. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily an emotion.
Right. So we would, even if it's not necessarily an emotion, I wouldn't necessarily put a strong stake in the ground and say those are always attitudes, but I would say those are sort of knowledge, or those are separate from how we're defining beliefs anyway.
Yeah.
I think Bob's working through some cognitive dissonance, but we're almost there.
Yeah.
I will say there's a paper in which the researchers, all they did in this paper was ask other belief researchers about their definition of beliefs and knowledge. And the point of the paper mm-hmm. was they got a whole lot of different answers from
I imagine.
Study this stuff. So
there's
not universal agreement about what these terms mean. And in fact, we've had some kind of back and forth with journal reviewers when we first started writing about beliefs, where we would send in our papers and the reviewers would say, well, that's not what a belief is. And so we kind of learned to just be clear about our definition up front and then try to press on.
I was going to say, going back to some of our primary work is define your terms, because you might find out you're talking about different things.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Bob.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So just one more part of this is that my understanding of your definition of beliefs is that those can be based either on logical arguments or emotions too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. But they are about things that we would call descriptive claims, things that are in the world that are not based on human values.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So people may say if somebody is a creationist and believes that the world was created by a God, and that what underlies that belief is a kind of worldview or belief system that is wrapped up in religion and is sort of arises from other related religious beliefs, then that would be a belief about what's true of the world, but that doesn't mean that it necessarily arises from a critical evaluation of scientific evidence. It could certainly arise from emotions or other kinds of values or things like that.
Okay, I got it. Now, how does this fit with the dual processing model? In other words, are attitudes in this way of thinking about them more intuitive and beliefs more rationally thinking about something or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. I think that the beliefs, you know, we've sort of tried to make a clear definition between beliefs and attitudes, but honestly, it is not at all clear to me that beliefs and attitudes act very differently in a lot of circumstances. In fact, I think there's not a clear understanding at all of exactly how or when they may be different. Certainly, beliefs are subject to irrational kinds of forces, and a lot of the research suggests that they act that way. In fact, I don't think there is much out there that is purely subject to reason and careful analysis. I think, honestly, we don't do a whole lot of that in our day-to-day life. We may wish that we did or like to think we do.
Yeah, and we're trying to encourage people to do more.
Sure, me too.
And that brings us to the idea that we are a show about critical thinking. What I'm thinking about here is, based on your present knowledge, you've done a lot of reading, thinking, and research on this. Give us the big picture of how our pre-existing beliefs are likely to affect our comprehension and critical appraisal of new information.
So I think that our previous beliefs affect our comprehension in that anytime we try to read or understand anything, it is always going to be a process of integrating new information into the knowledge or understandings that we already have. And this is kind of a grand point from text comprehension research, that our previous knowledge, including our beliefs, makes a difference. So in the case of beliefs, it may matter in terms of how we evaluate information. So as we take in information, say we're reading an article about some topic, one of the things we may do is just try to understand it or figure out what the author is saying, but we also may be generating inferences. We may be evaluating the information as we read. We may agree or disagree. And so this kind of extra information that's not just what the words on the page are saying, but these thoughts that we're generating, this all gets kind of added to our overall understanding or memory of what it is that we've read. So beliefs will influence that kind of process. Although I should say, what we've found in looking at people trying to understand information that is consistent or inconsistent with beliefs is that, from what we've found and what some others have found, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of difference. In other words, you know, we've done studies where we have creationists and people who believe in evolution both reading texts that describe the processes of evolution, and they both understand the information just as well. They're both able to answer questions about it. So there doesn't seem to be any big sort of block or hindrance in which reading something that you don't believe prevents you from understanding it. In terms of how beliefs affect critical appraisal of information, that's a big and multifaceted topic. And I would say one of the sort of high-level views is that often how we appraise or how we evaluate information depends on kind of what our motivations are. So our motivations are very important. If we are reading something and we are motivated to try to maintain or keep or reinforce a belief we have, then we're more likely to take in information that's consistent with that and kind of accept it without evaluating it very much. If we read information that is inconsistent with a belief or a position we have, there's a kind of mental toolbox that we have that lots of researchers have looked at. So various kinds of strategies that we have to discount the information. And you can see this in political discussions all the time. For example, if somebody presents me some information that I don't agree with, I could discount the source or denigrate the source and say, well, if this source is not trustworthy, then I'm free to just not consider that information. You can also declare something not a scientific question in the first place if somebody presents scientific evidence that you don't like, or they could present alternative data as a way of trying to hang on to the beliefs they have. And so I think one of the big picture questions is that you always have to kind of think about this question of why is somebody interested in this information in the first place. And on some occasions, accuracy may be their motivation, meaning people may be taking information with a genuine effort to try to understand it, reason it, and reach a conclusion based on evidence. But a lot of the time, that's not really what people are doing. So if you think, for example, I take a person who believes that vaccines are harmful, if this is something that you have stated publicly, maybe you're involved in social media groups with other people who think vaccines are harmful, if you read evidence and evaluate evidence that suggests that vaccines are helpful, there's a lot at stake for you if you want to consider changing your beliefs. So the appraisal that you would give of this information, right, if you're going to accept that vaccines are actually good, then for one, you would have to admit to yourself that perhaps you've been harming your child for all these years. For two, you may be part of a social group that's important to you. So the stakes are kind of high in that if you start believing that vaccines are helpful and not harmful, you may be kicked out of this group. So a lot of times we can look from the outside at people evaluating information and think, how can these people get this particular kind of information and not reach the same conclusion that I'm reaching? And sometimes the answer is that their motivations are just very different. Their motivations are not necessarily to accurately appraise the information, but the motivations may even have nothing to do with the actual information.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've talked about on this show, is that you can't be doing critical thinking every moment of the day in every piece of communication.
Nor would I want to.
Nor would you want
Certainly
to.
Certainly not. Yeah, well, that would be exhausting.
So it's important, and we've talked about this before, to know what your goals are, to have some sense of what your goals are. That's the hard part, though, because sometimes we don't have good enough self-awareness, really, to know clearly and accurately what our goals are. But it's one of the questions that I think is one of the most important questions for our listeners to ask yourself is, and to be honest with yourself, what are my goals in this particular piece of communication? Am I there to really try to get to the bottom of it, to really find out what's true with an open mind, or are my goals to persuade? Are my goals to identify with a group and to show that we're part of that group? Those are hard things to do, but if we can make that step, I think that's a great first step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm just going to chime in and remind listeners, it is 7:30 and you are tuned into Thinking Clearly on KMUD every first Thursday. We're discussing belief formation, influence of beliefs on reasoning, and belief change with psychology professor Michael Wolf from Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan.
And you've already gotten into this somewhat, but I'm interested. I'm a theory guy, and I'm interested in the theoretical structure of what you've talked about. One of your contributions has been to actually nail down the definitions between knowledge, belief, and attitude, and that's a great thing to do. It's a great contribution to the research is to nail down those definitions so people are not researching with different definitions. But the same can be done with theoretical structure that you're coming from as you're looking at your research and talking about these issues. And you made a contribution to the 2017 edition of the Routledge Handbook of Discourse Processes, along with your colleague, Thomas Griffin. And you tried to bring some order to the multitude of approaches of studying how our beliefs and attitudes affect our comprehension. In that piece, you say, quote, "We propose that methods of evaluating belief influence should be understood as addressing one of three aspects of comprehension." So can you give us a little bit of idea what are those three aspects?
Sure. So this is something in which Thomas Griffin and I come from, as I said, this kind of text comprehension background. And in that research literature, we talk a lot about these different dimensions, but people who study beliefs come from lots and lots of different disciplines. So one of the things that we proposed or suggested was separating out sort of when people are looking at belief-related processes or belief-related influences or comprehension. So one of the aspects that we pay attention to in the comprehension world is what we call processing, which is basically the mental activities that you are engaged in as you read or as you consume information. So there are kind of low-level aspects of processing, like figuring out what each word is as you read, but also figuring out what each sentence is saying, linking the ideas together in sentences, also relating what you are reading to other knowledge you have or to other opinions or generating inferences. So basically, processing refers to what you are doing while you are in the middle of reading. And then once reading is over, you have formed ideally some kind of memory or mental representation or understanding of the information. And so the mental representation is a term that we would use to describe essentially what you got out of the reading or what you remember. So you would use that if, for example, you watched a presidential debate and you were trying to tell somebody just what sort of the summary was, what each candidate was saying, and what points they were trying to get across. And so you're not necessarily trying to add your opinions or inject a lot of extra thoughts about that. You're just trying to convey the information. Mm-hmm. And so some tasks in research are, you know, we give people texts and then just ask them to remember as much as we can, as you can. So we'd say, you know, essentially, we're not asking what you thought of this information. We just want to know how well you understood it. So that's kind of a mental representation task. And then in other circumstances, we want people to evaluate or offer opinions or judgments about information. So we refer to those as evaluation tasks. So in the literature, there are studies in which people would have subjects, say, read information and then list their thoughts or write an argumentative essay in which you pick a side of an issue. You know, suppose you're reading about whether the Electoral College should be abolished and you read a pro and con, and then you have to write a position statement, right? That's what we would call an evaluation, meaning there isn't necessarily a right and wrong answer. You aren't obligated to use or remember accurately the information that you read. It's more your judgment. And you may or may not use some of the information that you read, but you are adding your opinions or trying to support your opinions. So we propose that when people study this, they should be clear in terms of which of these components of the process people are looking at. Are you talking about the mental processes that people go through as they read? Are you talking about just what they remember? Or are you talking about the kind of opinions and judgments that people form after they're done reading?
Yeah, in that same Rutledge article, you mentioned that people differ in regards to the extent that their belief is evidence-based or affect-based. And you also mentioned a self-report questionnaire that measures that. Could you tell us more about that and if that questionnaire is available?
Yeah, so this is something that really Thomas Griffin, my co-author, was kind of the originator of this idea. But basically, the idea is that people have beliefs. If you ask people why they believe certain things, they give different kinds of reasons, and that at least under some circumstances, those reasons can be important. And in particular, that people sometimes claim that their beliefs are based on evidence, and other times, kind of at what you could think of as another end of a scale, their beliefs are based on affect or emotions. And that can be particularly important, say, if you are trying to present evidence to somebody that relates to a particular topic. So again, if you are talking to a creationist who does not believe in evolution, and that person says, well, the reason why I don't believe it is because it is part of my sort of overall religious values, and they have a kind of biblical origin of this belief, then that would be kind of an affective reason for holding that belief. So if you were going to try to convince that person about evolution by presenting them a bunch of evidence about fossils, you're very unlikely to get this person to change their beliefs. And part of the reason is that you are giving them information, right, about fossils, which is just not the dimension on which they formed their belief in the first place, right? They would essentially, without saying it, they'd be saying, I'm not a creationist because I've carefully read the fossil evidence and find it unconvincing. I'm a creationist for a completely different set of reasons. And so the evidence just doesn't match why I hold this belief in the first place. You can see this kind of thing in current politics, for example, with this Ukraine issue with President Trump and Congress and so on, where, you know, you might imagine if somebody is a supporter of President Trump because they just like him, if they like the way he talks, for example, they may not be all that convinced or even interested in a careful evaluation of evidence about phone calls with the leaders of Ukraine and who's testifying what, in terms of the idea that that's going to change their stance on the president, because essentially that kind of evidence is not where they got their belief in the first place. And so if there's a kind of mismatch between what you're presenting people and why they hold their beliefs in the first place, they're kind of more likely to reject that evidence as something that they want to think about or take seriously.
Yeah, it seems like that questionnaire would be very, very valuable. Have you done validity and reliability studies at all and tried to turn that into an instrument?
Thomas Griffin has done that. It's actually only 5 questions. It's very short. So I published it in the appendix of a paper in Discourse Processes in 2013. Thomas Griffin has published that in a couple of journal articles, but it's very short. It's only 5 questions. And so it is out there. He's doing some more research on it currently. But yeah, it's a short instrument.
Well, I could see the value of actually working that into a longer instrument that has validity and reliability studies done on it, because it could be very useful and interesting to do research with that to sort people into the folks that might be more affective in their orientations versus people who might be more rational or reasoning-based and evidence-based. I think the cognitive reflection test has been used sort of in that vein to sort people according to the dual process model, the more intuitive people versus the more rational people.
Yes.
Okay, let's get into a little bit of what you found in your research. The takeaway for listeners of our show will be how our previous beliefs may affect our ability to evaluate the soundness of arguments. I mean, if our previous beliefs have a very strong influence, that kind of puts critical thinking, in a hard position. we'd be out of business in this show if that is really the case. So that and the degree to which people change their beliefs, because, I mean, we've all heard of the blowback effect. If we actually try to present arguments to people, sometimes it may crystallize them to become more convinced that they're right in their original argument. So take us through a little bit.
Briefly, I don't find that in my studies.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you do find in your studies.
Yeah. So a couple of things on the argument evaluation or the reasoning. Todd Williams and Chris Kirby and I have done some research on this, where we had people evaluate the soundness or the extent to which arguments are sort of flawed or sound or acceptable. Basically the way you evaluate that is that an argument has a claim and a reason. So just to give you a couple quick examples, these are all one sentence long, these arguments. So television violence does not cause real violence because violent television programs contain mostly males. That is what we would call an unsound or a flawed argument. And the reason is that there is a claim TV violence does not cause actual violence. But then the reason that supports the claim that TV programs contain mostly males is irrelevant or unrelated to the claim, right? So regardless of what you believe about TV violence, you should be able to read that argument and say that is a flawed argument because the reason is unrelated to the claim.
Yes.
So another example. Spanking is an effective means of discipline because methodologically sound studies have shown that spanking reduces aggression. So that we would call a sound argument because there's a claim spanking is an effective means of discipline. And the reason that sound studies have shown spanking reduces aggression is relevant to or related to the claim. So when people read arguments like that, if you are judging them just on the basis of whether they are flawed arguments or acceptable arguments, your beliefs should be irrelevant, right? Mm-hmm. We should be able to set aside whether we believe that spanking's effective or TV violence causes real violence. We may or may not be convinced by the arguments, but that's a different question than whether the reason is related to the claim. So we had people in a series of studies who fill out an online questionnaire before they do the task, where they report their beliefs on a scale about these topics, spanking effectiveness and TV violence and some others. And so when they come into the lab for the experiment, we already know what they believe about spanking and TV violence. And we have them read a whole series of these arguments and just rate whether the arguments are flawed or acceptable. And there are two ways that we can evaluate people's performance on this. One is in terms of their overall accuracy, which is just to say, can they call the acceptable arguments acceptable and the flawed arguments flawed? And then there's another question about bias, which is just overall, to what extent do people tend to say that arguments are flawed, or do they tend to say that arguments are acceptable? And basically what we find is when we look at arguments in which the claim of the argument about spanking or TV violence, if the claim of the argument matches their beliefs or doesn't match their beliefs, that has no influence on their accuracy. So people are no better or worse at judging the soundness of arguments based on whether they believe them or not. Mm-hmm. But we find strong effects with bias, which is to say, if you believe the claim of the argument, so if you're reading an argument about spanking effectiveness and you believe that spanking is effective, you are more likely to find that argument to be sound than if you don't believe the claim. Mm-hmm. And so we found this with both TV violence and spanking. We found it with both people who believe and don't believe the arguments. So the basic idea is that the basic finding is that we are biased in trying to judge the soundness of arguments. Basically, arguments that we are predisposed to already agree with, we are more likely not just to agree with them, but to actually think that they are valid, sound arguments. And arguments that we don't agree with, we are more likely to, again, not just disagree with them, but reject them as flawed or unsound arguments.
Mm-hmm. That kind of validates confirmation bias then.
Yes, I mean, it is a related, right? So the technical difference is that confirmation bias is about seeking out new information. And in this case, we are giving you the information and asking you to evaluate it. But it's a similar kind of phenomenon, yes, in terms of biases in which you favor things that you already agree with and you reject things that you don't agree with.
It's taken me a while for my brain to catch up, but I was thinking about evidence-based versus affect-based, and we kind of got into politics for a minute, and it brought me back to, remember when we talked about wanting to elect someone that you want to have a beer with? Someone you
yes.
can, it seems
yes.
like that's the affect-based, right?
Right, yeah.
People have wanted for, I don't know how long, people have wanted society to want to elect politicians where they do a careful analysis of their positions and they vote for people whose, you know, positions and things that they want to do line up with theirs. And over, we just keep finding that that's just not how people pick politicians. It's on their own economic self-interest either.
Yeah. We got our phones are ringing. We have some callers. I think we're ready to take our first caller.
Great.
Okay, caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi. I'm curious about the change part. I'm curious about what motivates change. You spoke about credibility and how it can be dismissed because of soundness, or it's flawed, or it's accurate, or it's acceptable, or biased, especially when someone's sort of deeply entrenched in a certain motivation. So I'm curious about, like, your fossil example. Is there anything about the content of the article or the argument that could mitigate the dismissal that has potential for change? Like, is there a secret sauce?
A way to break through that defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Great question. Thank you, caller.
Go ahead.
That is a really good question. The search for the secret sauce, I think that the first thing I would say is there is no secret sauce, meaning there is no sense in which if you just say it in the right way or you just present the right kind of evidence, then you can finally get people to adopt, to match their beliefs with evidence. There are several different strategies that are more likely than doing nothing to change people's beliefs. But all of them are things where they, you know, they work to some extent or to a matter of degree or with some people and not others. You know, in our studies, we didn't really get to our studies on belief change, but when we have people read extended evidence and arguments about topics where we know that they don't agree, we overall do get belief change. So we have gotten people to change their beliefs about TV violence influences. More recently, we've been studying gun control, and that one actually we weren't sure if anybody would change their beliefs about gun control, but they did. But in all of our studies, it is the case that about a third of people don't change their beliefs at all. About two-thirds change some, and of those who change, the change is all over the map. Very few change their beliefs from one extreme all the way to the other extreme. Usually the change is a matter of a degree of a little bit. And in our attempts to figure out who changes their beliefs and who doesn't, honestly, we have found a lot of things that don't predict who changes their beliefs. There are a couple of things from other labs that I'll say that have been shown to at least help. One is explaining underlying mechanisms behind a process. So, for example, climate change, if you just tell people that the climate is changing, that is less helpful than explaining the causal chain of events that lead from CO2 emissions to the Earth getting warmer. And part of the thought on why that seems to be effective is that it's harder to refute or just reject the conclusion if somebody presents a series of causal steps that lead from the initial event to the final outcome. Another thing is what in the text world is called a refutation text, which is to say if somebody has a misconception or a belief that's incorrect, just ignoring it and presenting correct information is unlikely to work. And that's something that's done in school a lot, where students come in believing all sorts of things that are not true, and often teachers or textbooks just present the correct information. It turns out that if you directly address a misconception and explain that the misconception is wrong and why it's wrong, and why the accurate information is a better explanation, you have a better chance of changing people's beliefs. So those are two things that seem to help. But as the caller mentioned, if you have somebody, say, who is really entrenched or their beliefs are part of some social aspect or something that's really important to them, there just is no simple answer or no real way to just say, if you just say it in the right way, you're going to get people to change. And, you know, it's easy to expect other people to change to your point of view, but then you would not be willing to have somebody, say, on the opposite end of the political spectrum to start telling you a bunch of evidence about things you don't believe and have you say, oh, you know, you're right. I believe the opposite my whole life, but now I've decided you're right. Kind of thing just is incredibly rare.
Some empathy comes in there. So thank you very much, caller, yes, for the great question.
It does seem like some willingness has to be there, you know, that it's at least, you know, so it's two-way conversation, I guess.
We jotted that down. Mechanism and counterpoint have shown to be effective. Okay, we've got a couple other callers on the line, and so let's take the next call. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello, yes. Caller.
Okay. I'm enjoying your show. And my life experience, I'm not a youngster anymore, I realize that lots of folks have a perception about something, whether it's a brand of a car, a brand of a piece of clothing, or a tool, and that there's an emotional component by which they make decisions oftentimes. And so, to me, for the most part, for example, I'm going to talk about the election, which is obvious. This is November, so it's a year away yet. But people vote the brand. They don't necessarily. Yes, there are intellectuals who study the situation, read all the information that's going on, and so forth, and maybe waver from one side or another, or one candidate to another. But the vast majority of people vote for the brand, the Republican brand or the Democratic brand. And that's the way it really is at the end of the day when you go to the voting booth. However, you have the reality in America where we are big consumers. We're the biggest consumer nation on the planet. So the science of selling me something, whether I don't care if it's a car or a tool or whatever, is quite sophisticated.
Let's hear Professor Wolf's critique of that.
Yeah,
what's your opinion?
I think that the caller is right, certainly about politics, but also about brands. I mean, part of what creates a brand sense, you know, there's a phenomenon in social psychology called the mere exposure effect, which just states that the more exposure you have to something, the more positively you feel about it, which is why we get bombarded with so many ads. You know, you don't even have to be deliberately thinking or reasoning about them. If ads are just kind of playing in the background, part of the hope is that they will just kind of sink in through your subconscious if you're not directly paying attention, and that'll be part of your kind of identity, or that will shape how positively or negatively you feel about things. And I think it's also true that people largely vote their party loyalties, you know, which is one of the reasons why it's kind of a political truism that you don't worry too much about persuasion. You try to get out your base, you know, which is a phrase you hear a lot, which is to say, rather than persuading people who don't like our side or our party, we're just going to try to take the people who will vote for us if they vote and make sure they get out there.
Okay, thank you, caller, and thank you for the answer. I think we have one more caller.
I have a quick comment. I just got to say, our next election is March 6th. That's the primary, and then it's November. Okay, yeah. Turn out March 6th. That's okay. All. Thank you. Next caller.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
I once had a college professor who had said something like, sometimes the gap is just too far. So I'm mostly kind of concerned or interested in terms of myself than trying to communicate with other people, because I feel like there's something about our attitude towards novel things, where the first thing we hear on the subject, we're most likely to believe. And as a child, obviously, our brains are malleable, but it seems like that sort of thing continues on well into adulthood. And how do we recognize novel information and process it from a cognitive point of view?
Great question.
All right, we got
Professor Wolf.
2 minutes.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So what counts as novel is a difficult question. I mean, one of the things I'll say is, I mean, we didn't really get to this, but if you, right, as you start to encounter information and form beliefs or form opinions about things, one of the things that we find is that people do tend to change sometimes, although we often feel like we don't. So you may have a tendency to feel like your beliefs or your opinions or your values are stable largely across your life. And maybe they are, but in many cases, they are more malleable than we think. And as it turns out, we seem to not necessarily be aware of these changes. So things may be new without us realizing it to some extent. And part of the problem with new information is you mentioned confirmation bias, which is a pretty strong effect. We often tend to not want to seek out new information. There is a personality dimension about desire to seek out new information. Openness to experience is one of the big five personality dimensions. And so there are individual differences in which, to some extent, some people just prefer or enjoy new information or new ideas more than others. And, you know, others prefer to not engage in new ideas. So to some extent, that is just an individual difference that people vary on.
Would that be considered an attitude, being open to information or being kind of closed off to information?
Oh, gosh, I would say, I mean, technically, that is a personality trait. Mm-hmm. So I would not call it an attitude. It is one of, so the big five is kind of a famous personality scale with five dimensions of personality. And so that is one of the dimensions. It is thought to be a
gotcha.
Kind of.
In our longer description of critical thinking, we have that that aspect, and we call it a mindset. You know, so that's
sure.
Kind of neutral. Great discussion. I really personally enjoyed it.
Yeah,
we had
thank
some great
you so
calls.
Much for joining us.
And as usual, we ran out of time. So
in the best sort of way.
Anything that you just want to give some contact information at all before we wind it up here?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a professor at Grand Valley State University. So you can find me if you look up gvsu.edu/psychology. You can find your way to the psychology department page, and you can find me there and look up information about my publications. And I've got a TED Talk I did about a year ago. There's a link to that there.
And we'll watch for your book when it comes out. Yeah, and we will post your information, contact information, on our Facebook page. So Dr. Michael Wolf, professor of psychology at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, thank you so much for being our guest on Thinking Clearly.
Well, thank you, Julie and Bob. It's been great.
Okay, have a good evening.
Have a good night.
And thanks to our engineer, Mitch. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.